Ah Sing may have imagined. What we do know is that she and Douglas frequently wrote about the same issues, often in similar tone and language. Douglas described his mission to Haiti as reflecting a citizen's need for study and travel, and a journalist's desire to report on and do justice to Haiti, to paint her as she is. He was going as well with a black man's pride in showing that Haiti was free, orderly, and independent, admitting also that he had always longed to stand on the soil of San Domingo, the theater of many stirring events and heroic achievements, the work of a people, bone of our bone and flesh of our flesh. He came close to recommending what he had earlier denounced, the charms of a colored nationality. He waxed exuberant about escaping Rochester's wintry cold for Haiti's tropical warmth. Politically, his trip was to observe whether the Haitian Republic might be an asylum from the apprehended storm which is about to beat pitilessly upon African Americans. Douglas could not have known that overnight he would be writing about a very different storm. On April 12th, before Douglas went to press with his paper, Confederate insurgents fired on Fort Sumter in Charleston Harbor, and the Civil War commenced. Douglas appended a brief postscript to his editorial, A Trip to Haiti. The editor tried to capture the nation's, as well as his own, sense of the drama of that moment. Since this article was put in type, we find ourselves in circumstances which induce us to forego our much-desired trip to Haiti. War fever surged through northern communities and turned a divided and anxious populace into a swarm of excited unity. In her columns, Ah Sing joined the journalistic fray, sometimes clearly modeling Douglas's writings in the monthly, which came out before she took up her pen. She described the news of Fort Sumter hitting New York City like a bolt of lightning, citizens so enthused as though walking on a volcano. She observed militia drilling in the streets, huge lines of men of all ethnicities volunteering for the army. At times she modeled Douglas's columns, but in other moments wrote with her own distinctive gusto. She witnessed Jefferson Davis depicted in a life-size effigy of straw and wood hanging from a banner over a street, flags waving everywhere on buildings, on carriages, and even on horses' heads. Douglas likely never read her columns, since they were written in German, although he was surely delighted to have some of his own ideas disseminated among German progressives. A world-changing event had occurred, and Douglas never missed a chance to instruct with events. The last 10 days have made a tremendous revolution in all things pertaining to the possible future of the colored people of the United States. Northerners, he said, had experienced some of the savage barbarism of slavery, and he would now do his part to teach them to make war upon it. I hated slavery, slaveholders, and all pertaining to them, Douglas wrote in Bondage and Freedom in 1855, and I did not fail to inspire others with the same feeling, wherever and whenever opportunity was presented. He crafted that passage, one of many in his autobiographies about his enduring rage against his oppressors, to capture the perceived danger and power of his newfound literacy among his fellow slaves. That literacy, he said, had made him a marked lad among the slaves and a suspected one among the slaveholders. To say the least, Douglas had always cherished this power to hurl words, and when necessary, hatred, against slavery and slaveholders. History had seemingly opened a broad door to a new opportunity to inspire a vast nation, as he had once done on Freeland's farm in Talbot County, Maryland, for a tiny band of brothers. But in the spring of 1861, Douglas complained that words and their meanings had been debased in the crisis of disunion. The strangest feature of this eventful drama is the complete inversion of the sense of words. Treason and armed rebellion were now simply the sovereign right of secession, and the execution of the laws is now called coercion. To Douglas, the secessionists were the mortal enemies of the government as they inspired resistance among abolitionists. Traitors merited no quarter. President James Buchanan was no mere benign lame duck, but the chief of sinners, and Douglas insisted over and again on his own label for the Deep South's revolution, the treasonable slaveholding Confederacy. Douglas had been practicing this kind of rhetoric for a long time. By 1861, it was as if the secessionists, as well as truckling Yankees, had flipped his switch into overdrive. Douglas seized the moment with a fervor as great as any other in his career. To him, the central meaning of secession and the coming of the war was that it raised at least the possibility of armed abolition, of mingling the cause of the slave and the rights of free black people with the life of the nation. "At last, our proud republic is overtaken," he enthused in April 1861 after Fort Sumter. Although he predicted that the nation would suffer untold destruction, the moment felt propitious, and the war welcome. "Now is the time to change the cry of vengeance long set up from the toiling bondman into a grateful prayer for the peace and safety of the government." He had rarely spoken of the United States government in such warm tones. This was only possible because he beheld a crisis that bound up the fate of the republic and that of the slave in the same bundle. Douglas put the fears of the secession winter aside now and rejoiced in the crisis. "The nation," he said, "has put one end of the chain upon the ankle of the bondman, and the other end about its own neck. In a land that must now weep and howl amid 10,000 desolations brought on by the sins of 2 centuries, he turned again to the old prophets for his own cry to the nation. "Repent, break every yoke, let the oppressed go free, for herein alone is deliverance and safety." For the next 4 years, Douglas's Civil War became his very own cry of vengeance. In a struggle Douglas and many others on both sides saw increasingly as a holy war over slavery and freedom, blame had to be precisely assigned to foment sufficient fervor and bloodlust to fight it. In a homespun set of metaphors, Douglas provided clear images about responsibility for the war, and he thus unveiled his apocalyptic sense of history, a belief in the occasional cosmic collision of forces, necessary rendings and bloodlettings, when God chose to enter history and overturn it for the creation of a new age. In an April 1861 editorial, "Who Killed the American Eagle?", Douglas seemed confident, at least, that the old Union was dead. By an old agreement between Mr. South and Mr. North, the eagle was to be raffled off between the contracting parties every 4 years, and whichever got the highest number was to take the bird for the next 4 years. For many years, Mr. South had regularly won the eagle and enjoyed its services. He had trained it to hunt slaves, to protect slave traders, to steal from Mexico, to tear the flesh of offensive strangers, to guard, protect, and extend slavery. Mr. North had always coveted this bird of prey, and he determined that if he should ever get possession of the eagle, he would teach him better manners and train him to better habits. At last, in 1860, Mr. North won the eagle, but before handing it over, as in honor bound, the treacherous Mr. South filled the unsuspecting bird with a heavy dose of secession powder, so that our once majestic bird was as good as dead. In this revealing vignette, Douglas shows his conception of the Union, a once powerful republic hopelessly corrupted by slavery. Why had the eagle died? The bird must die, Douglas argued, and the verdict of the inquest must be that it died of poison, treacherously administered at the instigation of Mr. South by one James Buchanan. Douglas used the word must to demonstrate his vision not only of secession, but of history itself. Slaveholders, in association with their northern accomplices, had killed the old Union. They must kill it, he reasoned, and it must die, for otherwise a new Union, a new nation with a new future, was not possible. Such metaphors only confirmed Douglas's deep desire for an overturning and remaking of America and of his faith in apocalyptic change. In 1861, Douglas's quest to fashion the enemy and to define the nature of the Union cause took many forms. His newspaper was never more important as a mouthpiece for his activism than in the first 2 years of the Civil War. Although he stayed closer to Rochester in 1861 than normal, Douglas held forth publicly nearly every Sunday afternoon from winter to late summer at the AME Zion Church. Some of the gatherings became so large that they relocated to the Rochester City Hall. As wartime so often necessitates, these were community solidarity gatherings, attended by blacks and whites, and crucial to sustaining morale in abnormally tense times. Douglas treated that pulpit at the corner of Spring and Havre Streets, a black church, as a place to conduct his own kind of war rallies. Like the rod of Moses, he declared on May 5th, which swallowed up all the petty creations of the Eastern magicians, "The awful and sublime crisis in our national affairs swallows up all other subjects." Just 2 days before, some 20,000 Rochesterites had gathered in the city center to watch and cheer as 8 companies of soldiers paraded to the train station and off to war to become the 13th New York Volunteers. Douglas celebrated the solemn departure of the troops, composed of the sons, brothers, husbands, and fathers of some of those who hear me. Although he had already argued a week earlier for the recruitment of colored regiments, no black men were part of that first Rochester war parade. Nevertheless, Douglas described the scene as a thrilling spectacle and admitted to witnessing it with feelings I cannot describe. But describe his feelings about the war is just what he did in the coming months. In those Sunday talks, Douglas also tried to represent the feelings of his audiences, especially blacks. That rod of Moses worked for them. "We cannot see the end from the beginning," he announced only 2 weeks into the war. "We live but today, and the measureless shores of the future are wisely hid from us. There is a general feeling amongst us that the control of events has been taken out of our hands, that we have fallen into the mighty current of invisible forces." As war fever swept over the land, conceptions of time and sensibility had changed. The world suddenly appeared both more dangerous and more exhilarating, and individuals felt a part of a larger whole, even as anxiety prevailed. For Douglas, the outbreak of war easily incited his practiced zeal to assault slavery in all its manifestations at a moment of special vulnerability. But the war also prompted untypical expressions of patriotism and American nationalism. He spoke for the oppressed and enslaved, Douglas said, but now he could also speak as an American. "All that I have and am are bound up with the destiny of this country." Douglas may never have completely stopped believing such sentiments, but they had rarely formed the key lines in speeches. "Of the American Republic," he told his Rochester neighbors, "I still feel that she is my country, and that I must fall or flourish with her." For the man who had often claimed he had no country, the events of April made him feel his patriotism. Fort Sumter and Lincoln's call for 75,000 volunteers to put down the rebellion had changed nearly everything, especially on Sunday afternoons. Before any major battles were fought, Douglas called for a long and merciless war that would not only root out and destroy secession, but the monster of slavery itself. He continued to grouse about the potential for compromises that might still be struck between cowed Northern politicians and Confederate leaders. "The spirit of compromise is still abroad here," he wrote in a June column. Fear seemed to rule most people in the North, who, he contended, cherish no deeper feeling against slavery than that which arises from a sense of mischief it does to the white race, and the troubles and dangers it brings upon the country. From England, Julia Crofts agreed and wrote for the Monthly of her own struggles to explain the reactions to secession in the North to her English friends. "The Southerners, of the two, are far better understood by us all. They act more straightforward in their course, bad as it is." But Northern reactions to potential war puzzled her, as she wielded adjectives as floridly as her Rochester colleague. "For the poor, timid, cowardly, servile, dishonest North, I can find no words to express the contempt I feel. They cannot be made to see the power they might wield in the sacred cause of human freedom. Northerners did not yet grasp that they had been visited, as Douglas contended, with a glorious opportunity at destruction and reinvention. At first, Douglas could hardly contain his combination of enthusiasm and rage. In the first month of the war, he prepared 3 full pages of articles and letters in his paper, detailing a litany of brutality, violence, rape, and other crimes in the South. He offered such a display as his chapter of horrors about the enemy, an illustration of the peculiar manners, temper, and morals of our slaveholding society. Gleaned from newspapers, North and South, the collection of brutalities, an old anti-slavery technique, included lynchings of Northerners, jailings of people with abolitionist sentiment, and all manner of beatings and duels. One fought over a mulatto girl. For clarity, Douglas boiled the notion of enemy down to 3 big ideas: slavery, treason, and rebellion, he argued, with a trio of social monsters that must be crushed. Stridently, he called for a war that must go on until one of the parties to it is ground to powder. The Union could only win a war to destroy slavery the longer it lasts. In the summer of 1861, the fire-breathing Douglas wanted slaveholding rebels starved out, broken down, overpowered, and totally exhausted before they can consent, after their high-sounding threat, to sue for peace. He stoked war fever with unabashed fervor, especially urging black men in his audiences to drink as deeply in the martial spirit of the times as possible, and to brandish their manliness so that they might never again be despised as cowards. Above all, he prayed for a long war that would subject the South to devastation. "I should regret the sudden and peaceful termination of this conflict," Douglas proclaimed. "Now, the next best thing, if we cannot make them, Southerners, love us, is to make them fear us." With these high, sanguinary aims, Douglas could only find disappointment in the short run. But in the war's first summer, he expressed a clamorous certainty about its meaning and purpose. The South's cause was an evil, growing, misbegotten element of nature itself that had to be wiped out. Slavery and its advocates, manifested in huge armies, were the foul and red-mouthed dragon against which Northern men must now learn war in order to slay it. In the dark art of war propaganda, thumping out from press and pulpit all over America that summer, Douglas set the pace for the abolitionist North. If his audiences needed moral and religious justification, he was ready. "Men have their choice in the world," Douglas pronounced in June. "They can be angels or they can be demons. In the apocalyptic vision, John describes a war in heaven. You have only to strip that vision of its gorgeous oriental drapery, divest it of its shining and celestial ornaments, clothe it in the simple and familiar language of common sense, and you will have the eternal conflict between right and wrong, good and evil, liberty and slavery, truth and falsehood." Then he tried to blend ancient biblical apocalypticism with the Union war effort. "Michael and his angels are still contending against the infernal host of bad passions, and excitement will last while the fight continues, till one or the other is subdued." Such is the struggle now going on in the United States. The slaveholders had rather reign in hell than serve in heaven. Thus did Douglas give the Civil War a cosmic definition on the eve of the Battle of First Bull Run. In the slaughter to come, he would provide as much bloodthirsty passion as he could for the side of the angels. Douglas's quest in 1861 to create the hated enemy of the Union cause was both personal and political. The outbreak of the war allowed him to cultivate a long-standing psychological need to find a real-world outlet for an inner vengeance against slavery and slaveholders. He had spent the first 28 years of his life as a slave, or a fugitive slave. His sense of self-definition took its departure from his slave origins as a child of a black mother and her white master. Douglas always had to begin to understand himself in the sordid but defining story of the sexual exploitation of slave women by white men. He was both a reflection of the system into which he was born, a chattel formed of both races, and therefore, especially with his high rise to intellectual fame, the most prominent contradiction of that system. Douglas had never resolved his anger toward his masters and overseers, toward their physical abuse, but perhaps especially about the mental oppression at the heart of slavery. He knew slavery as a potential total system rooted in dehumanization and violence. He knew slaveholders had hearts and souls, but he had also seen and experienced their dark depravity. His body had been possessed, manipulated, and bludgeoned by a man named Covey, and his future had once been owned and calculated by men named Auld and Anthony. Douglas understood the primal loathing, the soul-destroying elements in humanity, and the lethal force slavery required in order to survive. Slavery had also taught him a great deal about the uses of violence, and it had taught him how to hate. Once the bit of war propaganda lodged in his mouth, Douglas was relentless in pursuit of the enemy. He fits well into the writer Barbara Ehrenreich's characterization of how the war urge, once commenced, takes on a life of its own. "However and wherever war begins," wrote Ehrenreich, "it persists, it spreads, it propagates itself through time and across space with the terrifying tenacity of a beast attached to the neck of living prey." In June, at Spring Street Church, philosophizing as though he entertained a modern notion of innate aggression, Douglas dropped this telling line into the middle of his invocation of the apocalyptic vision from Revelation. "The human heart is a seat of constant war." The rage at the heart of the war propaganda Douglas produced so profusely in the Civil War stemmed less, though, from biological instinct than from emotion rooted in experience and ideas. He had his own war to pursue as he also primed the pump of Northern morale. Douglas's inner war stemmed from his desire to possess the power, the sense of belonging, indeed the realization of nationhood and citizenship that white men enjoyed. And it stemmed from fantasies of revenge, the deep desire to finally thwart and then destroy the physical, mental, and political worlds slavery had made. One world had to end before a new one could be created. Douglas engaged in a lifelong autobiographical quest for a coherent story of ascendance and familial identity. Douglas did carry a seat of constant war in his heart, as he himself implied. But that story was much more than the desire to comprehend his paternity, his bloodlines, and his kinfolk in Maryland. He needed revenge and redemption in blood for himself and for the afflicted generations of the people he represented. Douglas wanted slaveholders humiliated, then eliminated, and in their wake, he might find his place in a dominion of human equality. To get to that distant shore, to a new America, he probed the darkest ranges of human wrath. Douglas reveled in the war psychology exploding across the North in the summer of 1861. He did his best to cultivate the violent imagination of his readers and convert the older notion of the slave power, the object of abstract fear, into a hatred of slaveholders themselves. He wanted the high looks of the lordly Assyrians brought low. Echoing the war poems of Walt Whitman, but with blunter edges, Douglas beat his chest for war. "Drums are beating, men are enlisting," he wrote, "companies forming, regiments marching, banners are flying." He imagined a united North. "People, press, and pulpit are knitted together like the iron links of a coat of mail." He held nothing back. "The cry is now for war, vigorous war, war to the bitter end, and war till the traitors are effectually and permanently put down." In his view, no awful fate was quite enough for the slaveholding rebels. "Let the ports of the South be blockaded," Douglas preached. "Let business there be arrested. Let provisions, arms, and ammunition be no longer sent there. Let the grim visage of a northern army confront them from one direction, a furious slave insurrection meet them at another, and starvation threaten them from still another." In this early vision of total war, Douglas joyously imagined a horrendous end for slaveholders. They were only on the outer wave of the whirlpool of treason. Every circle they now make will bring them nearer the center that is certain to swallow them up and hurl them to the bottom of its howling waters. In such a tempest, Douglas, trying to see an unknowable end from the beginning, fashioned the apocalyptic fate of the Confederacy. As the war ensued, Douglas did his utmost to keep the character of slaveholders before the eyes and ears of his audiences. In the assault that ran counter to most Republican propaganda, Douglas portrayed non-slaveholding whites as mere tools of the slaveholders. They were ignorant, besotted, and servile, possessing no opinions of their own in political affairs. The power of the master class was absolute. "The slaveholders are the South," argued Douglas. "The 6 million of free non-slaveholding whites are but freight cars full of cattle attached to the 350,000 slaveholding locomotives. Where the locomotives go, the train must follow." In peace, the slave power was to be feared and opposed. In war, it was the barbarous and bloody culture that must be liquidated. In June, at one of his Spring Street Church lectures, Douglas demonstrated that he believed he had found the perfect enemy. "What is a slaveholder but a rebel and a traitor?" he queried. Douglas portrayed slaveholders as inherently depraved, natural criminals. He wanted his listeners to equate treason with slave owning, and therefore fight to destroy both. "Southern men," Douglas assured the assembled Rochesterites, "are all of the same species, and could understand no law but the law of force." Douglas's speeches were deeply personal illustrations of his vision of the conflict. "I want the monster destroyed," he shouted from the AME pulpit, fist clenched, fire in his eyes. Douglas envisioned the revolution the country now faced as an excellent instructor, especially about the nature of the enemy. He saw an America experiencing an epic upheaval. The drama needed a plot and direction, heroes and villains, and Douglas possessed a ready-made narrative. The slaveholders and their insatiable desires for more expansion, profits, power, and therefore more human chattel to achieve their aims, had overreached and brought down divine wrath and a political revolution to resist them. Douglas was fond of the Greek proverb that he employed in one of his Sunday lectures: "Whom the gods would destroy, they first make mad." In editorials later in the summer, he would put it other ways. "The slaveholder must be master of society, otherwise he cannot long be master of slaves." Douglas's greatest hope was that a sufficiently outraged northern people would fight to defeat this mortal enemy of humankind. By the end of the first summer of the war, though, Douglas was deeply frustrated with northern public opinion, the government's policy toward slavery, and military defeat. He was especially angry with federal insistence on returning fugitive slaves who had escaped to Union lines, and he hoped that the Union debacle at Bull Run in late July would teach the North harsh lessons. The salutary reaction to Bull Run was common among abolitionists and conservative intellectuals alike. In defeat, Douglas wanted the North to learn the necessity of effectively putting down the whole class of pestiferous slaveholders, so that the nation shall know them no more, except in history, to be execrated and loathed with all other robbers and tyrants which have cursed and ruined human society. Throughout the first 2 years of the conflict, such a quest to make Yankees hate slaveholders was a constant theme of Douglas's war of words. In his conception, Northerners did not comprehend the exterminating vigor of a settled and deadly hate with which Southerners prosecuted the war. Only when Northerners felt the same quenchless fire of a deadly hate, he wrote in August 1861, would they find the secret to military success. The South was in earnest and understood its cause, Douglas maintained, while the North did not. He equated Northern resolve with the willingness to kill slaveholders and all that they stood for. Douglas would have to wait a long and discouraging year before he would see the war turn decisively against slavery as well as the Confederacy. By the autumn of 1861, he seemed certain of his own duty. This time, the duty of hope was not merely to prescribe political faith in the face of pro-slavery laws and institutions. It entailed bloodlust, and looking long and hard at a dark reality neither he nor any other Americans had ever quite seen. Savage, prolonged, all-out civil war. Everything was at stake. The dangerous and demonical character of slavery we have been endeavoring to expose, he wrote in October, and to teach the nation they must hate and abolish, or be hated and abolished by it. As massive mobilization ensued in late 1861, and as Union and Confederate armies arrayed in Virginia, Kentucky, Tennessee, and many other places, Douglas predicted a long, revengeful, and desolating war. Only in an unlimited war, he believed, would slavery crumble by iron necessity, if not from moral idealism. Responding to a disheartened correspondent who challenged his optimism, he defended his sense of hope, as he warned that Northerners had not yet been sufficiently deluged with slaveholding contempt, not drunk deep enough of the poisoned cup of slaveholding malignity. They had not yet learned to hate a foe, and Douglas saw himself as their educator. Douglas made the most of every opportunity to instill contempt for the South. When allegations were made of atrocities by Confederate soldiers, he printed and exploited the stories. In August, he recycled the story that Confederates at Bull Run had amused themselves in sticking their bayonets in the dead and setting the wounded up against stumps and shooting at them as targets. In December 1861, under the heading Signs of Barbarism, he reported the claim that Virginia rebels had produced candles made of the tallow from dead Yankee soldiers. He also reprinted an account from the New York Post reporting the distribution of the skin of old John Brown's son, who had been killed in battle. According to Douglas, these episodes demonstrated that if left to themselves, the Southerners would wholly barbarize under the influence of slavery. What moral sense they did possess, he maintained, was due only to their connection with the superior civilization of the North. By 1862, Douglas portrayed slaveholders as barbarians, digging up the bones of our dead soldiers slain in battle, making drinking vessels out of their skulls, drumsticks out of their arm bones, slaying our wounded soldiers on the field of carnage, were only some of the wild accusations Douglas flung at Southerners. For Union military success, a deadly hatred of all things born of a slaveholding society would have to be engendered in the hearts and minds of Northerners. Although they seem vicious and even simplistic, Douglas's appeals for hatred of the South fit his apocalyptic conception of the war. God's retribution was at the heart of millennial expectations in the 19th century. Evil was to be eradicated through great calamity. A new age of peace and justice might then follow. But millennialism was an activist faith. The overturning of a society depended greatly on human action. Douglas's own sense of revenge against slaveholders came unleashed, as he passionately vented a long pent-up desire for righteous violence in the cause of abolition. He felt freed to advocate the death of every Edward Covey in the South. Thus hatred provided a creative force. Douglas envisioned a war that might be enduring and tragic, but also cleansing. Hatred of slaveholders, therefore, had great purgative power, for one human heart, or for millions, and an appointed role in America's Armageddon. By the late summer and into the fall of 1861, Douglas found himself frustrated as the Union armies and the Lincoln administration seemed determined not to make war on slavery, nor to liberate slaves who sought refuge behind Union lines, and especially not to accept black men into military service. Without knowing yet just what large armies could do to each other, nor the character of the destruction that rifled muskets and cannon could exact en masse on human bodies, Douglas ached in July for real war to begin. We know that rebellion cannot be talked down, written down, or coaxed down, he asserted with relish. It has got to be beaten down. There is no whipping the traitors without hurting them. War was made to hurt, and those who provoke it ought to be hurt, and the only conceivable good which can come out of war comes because it hurts. But Douglas had left his keenly interested British correspondent, Julia Crofts, in a lurch of inadequate information. It was in the railway carriage, she reported, while coming from Edinburgh, that the sounds Defeat of the Federals, Bull Run, Manassas Junction first met my ears. Julia felt shame in hearing the gentleman on her train express joy that the Union cowards had been defeated, as she besieged Douglas to provide the numbers really killed. She could only send her heartfelt wish that every colored family in the northern states would cross into Canada and live sheltered beneath the British flag. Desperate, Julia then broke into a typically religious exhortation. God reigns in eternity. We know and feel that he will overrule all this confusion, this wrath of men and clang of arms, for the final deliverance of the poor bondsmen, out of the prison houses, surely as he brought the children of Israel out of Egypt. Julia had read her Douglas and knew something of her friend's views on how such assurances marched with confusion, wrath, and war. And he surely took reassurance from her words. Before the war reached its second month, some slaves found their way into Union lines around the rim of southern war fronts and were famously labeled contrabands of war at Fortress Monroe, Virginia, by Union General Benjamin Butler. The idea of escaped slaves as confiscated enemy property caught on in the northern imagination, and a new word entered the national lexicon. For most of 1861, federal military policy about slavery, however, evolved in an incoherent, topsy-turvy manner, sometimes ordering Union officers to return fugitive slaves to their owners, and sometimes protecting and liberating the growing waves of runaways. In his paper, Douglas reprinted the leaked correspondence from Secretary of War Simon Cameron to Butler, informing the general that his bold order was approved, although the actual final determination of the freedmen's legal status would be left for the future. Officially, the Lincoln administration avoided measures that might lead to any wholesale emancipation, fearing that the four border slave states, especially Kentucky, might join the Confederacy otherwise, and therefore sought to restore the Union without enlisting black soldiers or making a revolutionary assault on slavery itself. Throughout the war's first year, these two profound issues, the status of fugitive slaves and the prospect of black enlistment in the military, dominated Douglas's mind and therefore his journalism. He was hardly alone. It seemed that everyone across the northern press and in political circles was talking about the contrabands. Even poets and songwriters appropriated the new concept. From the opening months of the war, Douglas argued vehemently for the recruitment of black troops. Borrowing language from Old Brown, he demanded a liberating army of slaves and free colored people carrying the war into Africa. His war fever surging, Douglas proclaimed that symbolically, one black regiment alone would be, in such a war, the full equal of two white ones, and teach the slaves themselves more than 1,000 preachers. Earlier in the war than most scholars may realize, northern journalists and buck privates alike began to wonder how emancipation might become a military necessity for the Union cause. On June 15, 1861, the Chicago Tribune spoke for many mainstream newspapers in concluding, "If the war continues 1 year or more, what will we do with the slaves will become the question of the day." Douglas agreed entirely, but hardly with the patience and dispatch of a reporter. He was the moral zeal of militant activism, although he put his faith in events as much as people. "Though it is generally true," he wrote in August, "that governments move only as they are moved upon by the people, they do sometimes find themselves moved by events which they cannot control." In this instance, Douglas was painfully prophetic in naming the problem at the heart of the strife engulfing the country. From the beginning of secession, Douglas had called the crisis the Slaveholders' Rebellion. Since Fort Sumter, he had called for an abolition war, and nothing short of it. When we consider his impatience with the Lincoln administration's halting and sometimes hostile approach to emancipation, it is worth contemplating the lens through which Douglas judged the war's purpose. In August, Douglas righteously claimed that everyone knows that this is the slaveholders' rebellion and nothing else. The war, he said, was the work of a privileged class of irresponsible despots, authorized tyrants and bloodsuckers, who fasten upon the Negro's flesh and draw political power and consequence from their legalized crimes. It is against that rhetorical background that we should understand Douglas's response to the most controversial issue of late 1861 in the Northern war effort. On August 30th, General John C. Fremont, commanding Union forces in Missouri, then racked with chaos and outbreaks of guerrilla war, declared martial law, ordering the summary executions of rebels, confiscation of their property, and most important, emancipation of the slaves of Confederates. Fremont acted without authorization from Lincoln or any higher military command, although with tumultuous approval among abolitionists. President Lincoln, to sustain civilian control of the military and especially sensitive to keeping Kentucky securely in the Union, promptly revoked Fremont's declaration and eventually removed him from command. Infuriated, Douglas struck with rhetorical vengeance against Lincoln's revocation of Fremont's emancipation edict. Throughout the autumn, joining a chorus of abolitionists, he made a heroic figure out of the inept Fremont and a symbol of the emancipation edict. He argued that the general had been sacrificed to appease the pro-slavery sentiment of the border states and because of Lincoln's constitutional conservatism. Not without reason, historian James Oakes portrays Douglas's reactions to the Fremont affair as an example of the abolitionists' sourest invective against Lincoln's caution. Oakes calls Douglas myopic in his impatience with federal policy, and a flexible dogmatist, who simply refused to grasp the burdens and imperatives of a president conducting a civil war. Fair enough, but Douglas's priorities and aims were not the same as Lincoln's, and Douglas's impatience drew upon the blood of untold millions of the enslaved, not on the question of constitutional authority. Lincoln had to consider public opinion at every turn in the story of emancipation. Douglas's goal, as it had always been, was to bend and shape that opinion toward just the kind of revolution and conflict Fremont had touched off in Missouri. Douglas's scornfulness and disdain for legalism were a duty, just as Lincoln possessed a profound duty to try to navigate uncharted constitutional waters. Lincoln had to worry about voters. Douglas wanted slaveholders' rights and their armies crushed in order to educate a new generation of anti-slavery voters. If the conflict was ever to truly be an abolition war, and if slavery was, as Douglas frequently claimed, the stomach of the rebellion, then, in his view, the border states, rather than being crucial and sensitive allies, were the millstone around the neck of the government. Who needs such friendship, Douglas argued, when it only serves as a shield to the treason of the cotton states? He engaged in faulty strategic thinking, but good abolitionist politics. Douglas spewed even more scorn on Lincoln's constitutional restraint about property rights. As if this were a time to talk of constitutional power, Douglas exhorted. He wanted Lincoln to seize the war power and use it as a moral weapon. Douglas's invective became ugly in October. He characterized Lincoln's thwarting of Fremont as a sign of weakness, imbecility, and absurdity. Douglas had hoped Fremont's order might be the hinge upon which the character of the war was to turn. Instead, the cunning technicalities of the crafty lawyer won out over the cannon and courage of the determined warrior. No one knew the future in this terrible war. Timing mattered, but no one should have expected patience from Douglas or any other radical abolitionist. He could not have known about the remarkable private remark Lincoln made that fall about the attitudes of the radicals. Abolitionists, said Lincoln, would upset our apple cart if they had their way. We'll fetch 'em, slaves, the president is reported to have said. Just give us a little time. We didn't go into this war to put down slavery, but to put the flag back, for I never should have had votes enough to send me here if the people had supposed I would use my power to upset slavery. We must wait until every other means have been exhausted. This thunderbolt will wait. Likewise in December, Lincoln and his aides probably did not read the passage embedded in one of Douglas's editorials on the Fremont affair. After saying that the general's proclamation would never be forgotten, and declaring the war part of a design that would ultimately succeed, Douglas, liberally wielding italics, dropped this prediction into the mix. In 3 years more, the people will sanction the death of slavery in the man of their choice. And two, this unnatural war will render its death constitutional. From their own peculiar dispositions, both men saw the thunder coming in 1862 and beyond. But Douglas could not yet hear the thunder. Lincoln had moved in quiet and small ways to authorize emancipation and even the beginnings of black military service in 1861. But Douglas did not know it. The president had grudgingly supported the first Confiscation Act, passed by Congress in August, which included slaves in the property that Union troops could seize from Confederates. The freedom of such persons was not yet legally determined, but this was an important beginning. In his first annual message to Congress, submitted December 3, 1861, Lincoln, with rigid caution, reiterated his pledge to protect the slave property of loyal Southerners. He expressed solicitude toward the four border states to keep them in the Union. Most important in Douglas's mind, Lincoln discouragingly began to lay out a plan of colonization for any slaves liberated in the growing war, an issue the editor would take up with great vehemence in the coming year. He could not have been surprised to see Lincoln declare once again the integrity of the Union to be the primary goal of the war. But perhaps nothing sank Douglas's heart as much as when he read the president's famous statement of how anxious and careful he had been that the war shall not degenerate into a violent and remorseless revolutionary struggle. Lincoln received heavy criticism for the caution in his annual message from parts of the North. The Illinois Senator Lyman Trumbull, a close friend of the president's, received many constituent letters protesting that Lincoln's address contained no battle cry for the Union war effort. Douglas wanted precisely the revolutionary struggle that Lincoln did not at this stage want. And Douglas was more than ready to provide the battle cry roaring in the ears of all who would listen. To one of his own readers, eager for hope, Douglas pointed to the higher law at work overturning constitutional restraint and to the mighty current moving the war toward radical ends. "Keep pounding on the rock," Douglas prescribed, "and listen for the thunder." Chapter 18. The Anthem of the Redeemed. It is difficult for us who have toiled so long and hard to believe that this event, so stupendous, so far-reaching and glorious, is even at the door. Frederick Douglass, Rochester, December 28, 1862. On Sunday, December 28, 1862, after hundreds of thousands of words, nearly as many back-breaking miles traveled, and 21 months of bloody civil war, Frederick Douglass stepped to the familiar pulpit of Spring Street AME Zion Church in Rochester and uttered a remarkable paragraph. In words and sentiments he had dreamed of saying for most of his nearly 43 years, the striking, well-attired orator, with a graying streak swooshed over the right side of his hair, began almost plaintively, declaring it scarcely a day for prose. Offering no apologetics for garnering the congregation's time and attention, Douglas summoned the old dream into the church sanctuary and invested his audience in a moment they might never forget. "It is a day for poetry and song." "A new song," said the preacher. Then he delivered a piece of prose poetry he had stored up inside since his first time in an AME Zion pulpit 23 years earlier in New Bedford. These cloudless skies, this balmy air, this brilliant sunshine, making December as pleasant as May, are in harmony with the glorious morning of liberty about to dawn upon us. Eyes must have welled up in the pews among black and white abolitionist Rochester as Douglas captured their feelings. Out of a full heart and sacred emotion, I congratulate you, my friends and fellow citizens, on the high and hopeful condition of the cause of human freedom and the cause of our common country. For these two causes are now one and inseparable and must stand or fall together. It had not yet officially happened, but Douglas offered his own kind of prayer of assurance as the faithful kept watch for the day of Jubilee. This sacred Sunday, in all the likelihoods of the case, is the last which will witness the existence of legal slavery in all the rebel slaveholding states of America. Then he folded some Lincoln-esque legal phrasing into an old abolitionist standby drawn from John Wesley, while landing a direct blow on Roger B. Taney of Dred Scott case infamy. Henceforth and forever, slavery in those states is to be recognized by all the departments of the American government under its appropriate character as an unmitigated robber and pirate, branded as the sum of all villainy, an outlaw having no rights which any man, white or colored, is bound to respect. Taking a breath, and perhaps choking down his own emotion, Douglas finished the opening of his praise song. It is difficult for us who have toiled so long and hard to believe that this event, so stupendous, so far-reaching and glorious, is even now at the door. It surpasses our most enthusiastic hopes that we live at such a time and are likely to witness the downfall, at least the legal downfall, of slavery in America. As the congregation nodded with recognition, he concluded, "It is a moment for joy, thanksgiving, and praise." The following day, Douglas boarded a train for Boston to join in a special gathering that would keep watch for the word. The road to such anticipated joy about emancipation was crooked, bloody, and at times laden with blind curves. In mid-November 1861, in Syracuse, New York, Douglas encountered threats of a lynch mob. Before his scheduled two-speech billing, potential assassins had flooded the town with handbills announcing "Nigger Fred coming," calling the orator, among other epithets, a reviler of the Constitution, a thief, rascal, and traitor. The handbills called on people to rally and give Douglas a warm reception. Due to the quick work of the mayor and local sheriff, who called on 70 police and some 45 young troops from the nearby army camp, no violence occurred, and Douglas, guarded by soldiers with loaded muskets, spoke for well over an hour on the causes of the rebellion before 800 people. Douglas thanked his protectors as he acknowledged a historical moment when the mob howls and slavery with bloody hands is throttling the liberties of the nation. Violence dominated everyone's mind. In the year and 9 months leading up to Abraham Lincoln signing the Emancipation Proclamation on January 1, 1863, approximately 270,000 Union soldiers and sailors and 212,000 Confederates had died or were wounded in the Civil War at heretofore unknown places called Fort Donelson, Shiloh, Seven Pines, Malvern Hill, Cedar Mountain, Manassas Junction, Antietam, or Mary's Heights at Fredericksburg. Such scale of sacrifice had been unthinkable in 1860, but now it occupied the daily consciousness of most Americans. The long war Douglas desired was underway. By spring 1862, he declared the conflict no longer a short war, either in fact or in imagination, but one the end of which is away off in the dark and misty future. Written in blood, the very nature of the war transformed. A rising tide of African-American slaves kept testing every battlefront, waterway, or Union Army outpost to seek their freedom. Douglas scoured newspapers for news, and in December 1861, he reprinted more than a dozen accounts of daring escapes by contrabands in war zones. Far from docile, slaves were alert and aggressive. "The Negroes at the South," he wrote, "are shown to be as keenly alive to the events going on about them as the majority of their masters, and quite ready to take their freedom in any way that is presented to them." Any way, indeed. Uncounted numbers of freed people were dying or suffering with disease in contraband camps all around the perimeter of the South. The Jubilee had arrived, forged by bravery and through fear and loss, well before it was signed into law. From 1861 to 1863, Douglas devoted his daily labors to fomenting an abolition war. Along with other abolitionists, Douglas passed through many valleys of fear and confusion before they ever found a sacred Sunday, such as the one he described in December 1862. Indeed, 1 year earlier, he and Gerrit Smith had exchanged depressing letters. Douglas despaired of finding any sound place upon which to build a hope of national salvation. "I am bewildered by the spectacle of moral blindness and helpless imbecility which the government of Lincoln presents. Is there hope?" 3 days later, Smith replied by sending $10 to sustain your paper, but remarking in somber tones, "I cannot get rid of the impression that our country is lost." The two men felt especially discouraged by the Lincoln administration's embroilment in the Trent Affair, a diplomatic standoff between Great Britain and the United States. The primary aim of Confederate diplomacy was to secure European and especially British recognition, and if possible, intervention on their behalf. In September, the Confederate government appointed James Mason of Virginia and John Slidell of Louisiana as ministers plenipotentiary to Britain and France, respectively. The two slipped through the Union blockade, but when they stopped in the harbor of Havana, Cuba, to switch to a British ship, the Trent, they were seized as contraband of war. The capture quickly became a diplomatic crisis. The London government cried foul, and Prime Minister Palmerston ordered troops to Canada, strengthened the British Atlantic fleet, and sent an ultimatum to the Lincoln administration demanding an apology and release of the Confederate envoys. After much saber-rattling on both sides, the United States saved face on December 25, 1861, by allowing Mason and Slidell to continue on to the foreign capitals. In the midst of this crisis, Julia Crofts wrote from England in a state of great fear over her native country's probable war with America. "Everyone but the Cotton Party," she wrote, shudders at the thought. "If war with Britain happened," she urged Douglas to cross the frontier with all your household and edit your paper at Toronto. After many weeks of these tensions, Douglas complained of confusion and contradiction in Washington. He thought the Trent Affair another measure of the hesitating, doubting, shrinking approach of Lincoln's government to the real issue of fighting slavery. "Our honor cannot require England's dishonor," wrote Douglas, the Anglophile. Above all, Douglas wanted to prevent British intervention and to enlist English abolitionists in the crusade to end slavery. Wartime heightens anxiety as it also alters conceptions of time itself, not only for combatants, but for civilians, who must follow its every desperate surge or drought of news. In particular, 1862 was just such a year. Little would ever be the same again. War possesses an awful logic and causes a psychic drama like few other human experiences. The direction and tide of the Civil War could change with any military success or failure. As Douglas said at the beginning of the year, "But a single day, but a single event may change the whole prospect. Let us, therefore, hope for that day and continue to labor for that event." His mood swings in 1862 were like recurring earthquakes, some destructive, and others reordering the landscape with astonishing new hope. Douglas did not find it easy to follow his friend Julia Croft's prescription for their mutual frustration about the war. While we labor for the redemption of the bondmen, we must learn also to wait. They shared a faith in an activist divine providence, but not in Christian fatalism. During a midwinter lull in